Hey, welcome to North Coast Church. Today, Pastor Chris Brown is bringing the teaching to you, so open up your Bibles and listen in.
He had actually woken up early and gone outside his tent long before the sun had come up. Sleep didn't come that much night at all. He could have used the extra hour of time change. He put on his battle gear. He fastened his weapons, checked them twice. And he slowly made his way about the camp as the hills and the east started to turn that gray and an orange as the ball of fire started to rise. One by one, his men would get out and they would do the same. Fires would be going, something to eat, something to give nourishment for the long day that was bound to come. And they would sit and wait for orders. And when they came, it was his job. He would muster that strength, that courage to stand in front of the man and let them know, we will not be on the defensive, we will be on the attack. And he saw the fear in each of their eyes. He was trying to hold it back from his own. And they assembled in rank and file, and they started making their way down the hills, reaching across to the plains. And there his small band of men would see them, out in the open field, 900 tanks, plus an army. And every man going through the exact same thing. What in the world are we doing? How in the world did we ever get here? Well, it's because of a woman. So many battles, it seems, between men have been about a woman. This one will take a turn. This one will be one of the most unlikely of stories. And this one today, I promise you, you're going to walk out and go, that is one of my favorite stories of all time. And I want you to see it with your own eyes. I want you to hear it with your own ears. And so open your Bible to a book called Judges. It's only seven books into the Bible. You're going to start with Genesis. And you're going to pass Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, Joshua, and then Judges. Judges, turn the first page. If you don't know where it is, seven pages in or seven books in. If you find anything with a first and second on it, you've gone too far. If you need it, there's a table of contents in the front. Turn to the book of Judges, chapter 1, verse 1. I'm going to teach the entire book of Judges in three verses. You're going to be, seriously? Seriously. We're going to start in chapter 1. I'm going to read you the end of the chapter, and then we'll find our story. But I want you to know what's happening, the time and the place. I want to give you context to what's going on in the story. And in Judges, chapter 1, verse 1, it tells us all we need to know. After the death of Joshua, the Israelites asked the Lord, who will be the first to go up and fight for us against the Canaanites? And look at verse 19. Then the Lord was with the men of Judah. They took possession of the hill country, but, circle, highlight, underline, but. You have some big buts in your life. Don't point at anybody. But you have some big buts in your life. Hey, God's with me. But let me tell you what happened. This is a huge one for Israel. But they were unable to drive out the people from the plains because they had iron chariots. And now we are going to know what happens for the next 300 years. This book will cover a period of time from about 1300 BC to about 1000 BC. 300 years of the life of Israel. Where in verse 1, we find out that who has died. Now get this. Get this as far as a nation goes. So let me use a little bit more of our vernacular, if we will. The nation of Israel is basically brand new at this point. They were slaves down in Egypt. God brought their first president, if you will, Moses. Now what a president. Your president frees the slaves. Not slaves you had. All of you were slaves. Your president frees you as slaves, brings you out of Egypt, the plagues, the splitting of the Red Sea, brings you to a land the Bible calls the promised land, a land that's flowing with milk and honey. It's going to be a great land for your people. And on the way, your president Moses goes up to a mountain called Sinai, and there he talks with God, and God gives him the law. We have the books of the law. We have the Torah. We have Genesis and Exodus, the story I'm talking about. We have Leviticus and Numbers and Deuteronomy. And you have everything you need. And your first president gave you freedom. He gave you the land. He gave you the law and how to be right with your Lord. And he has set you up. What a president. Plus, if you don't like him, his stick turns into a snake. And that's a really cool thing. You get a lot of votes that way. That's Moses. Moses dies. Your second president, Joshua. Now, if Moses brought you to the land, Joshua was your greatest military president. I mean, you've only had two. You've had the greatest leader maybe the world's ever seen, and now you have the greatest military leader. And Joshua is the one that's going to take you into the land and handle the battles for you. He's going to be your general. And both those guys are gone. And verse 1 tells us your people are without a president. And verse 19 tells us your people have stopped short of everything they were supposed to do. They cleaned the land until they came to those with iron chariots, tanks, until it came to the hard stuff. You followed God until it came to a place where it was really going to cost you. You followed God as long as everything was great and the law and the land until you got to the difficult times. And then you just conveniently stopped following God. And the people you left are going to come back and bite you for the next 300 years. I think it was 2 weeks ago now, I covered those passages of those battles in the Bible where God says, I want you to destroy every man, woman, and child. And so many of us go, how can that happen? How can a loving God say that type of stuff? And a couple weeks ago, we stopped and we looked at a guy named Achan. I'm telling you that name in case you weren't here, because I'm not going to tell you all that we talked about. It's free. It's online. You can watch it, download it, listen to it however you want. And we hit those tough passages on why God said to wipe out all these people for 400 years, the most vile, corrupt group of people, the child sacrifices, the child brutality that was going on, the open orgies, the temple prostitution. And we took a little bit of a dive into why did these people need to be removed? And maybe it was the most loving, just act for the rest of the nations, for this entire group to be destroyed. But when it came to the people in the plains, these people that had chariots, Israel stopped. And now I'm going to take you to the last page in the book. And we've done the entire book of Judges. Chapter 21, very last sentence in the book, 25. Judges 21, 25. Judges 21, 25 simply says this, and in those days, Israel had no king. Everyone did as he saw fit. And now you have the 300 years of God's people saying, we're going to follow you, but when it gets real difficult, when it gets hard, we're just going to stop. We can't go ahead with this. The people that they leave in the land are going to come back and constantly bite them in the butt. The people that they leave in the land are going to constantly come back and either oppress them or allow them in. You're following one God with a bunch of rules? Why don't you join us for a while? Every man does as he sees fit. You don't have to have a king. You don't have to have a ruler over your life. Do as you see fit. And Israel will fall into a pattern over and over again of following God. Things get tough. We're going to do as we see fit. And I want to take you into one of those patterns, chapter 4, in one of the coolest stories in the Bible. And you're sitting there going, that was the introduction? Yep. Judges, chapter 4, verse 1. Got it? Ready? Chapter 4. Don't look at me. You got the Word of God. Word of Chris ain't going to do jack for you. Judges 4, verse 1. After Ehud died, the Israelites once again, circle, highlight, underline, once again did evil in the eyes of the Lord. So the Lord sold them into the hands of Jabin, a king of Canaan, who reigned in Hazor. The commander of his army was Sisera, who lived in Harosheth Hagoyim, because he had 900 iron chariots and had cruelly oppressed the Israelites for 20 years. They cried out to the Lord for help. Three verses, I want to give you the problem. Then we're going to get into this battle. Three verses where Israel find themselves. My bet is some of us might find ourselves today. Three verses in your note sheet with the problem. I want to give you this. Sin is a cycle of staleness and slavery. And they're going to hit it once again, once again, once again. Once again, they're going to keep choosing what's right in their own eyes. Israel once again did evil. Israel once again chose their own life, their own lifestyles, their own desires, their own wants, their own freedoms, their own hopes, their own goals, their own dreams. Israel once again stopped short of what God wanted them to do. Once again. And they get in this pattern of staleness, slavery. Have you been there? It's not quite Egypt. I mean, in Egypt, they were really slaves. In Egypt, Pharaoh was beating on them. In Egypt, they had to make bricks. In Egypt, they had to build the architecture, the empire, the infrastructure for another empire. They were freed from that. They're no longer in slavery. They're in the promised land, but it's not flowing with milk and honey. We're being oppressed. We're being beaten down. There's guys with 900 chariots that are having their way with us, the raping and the pillaging. And you're not in slavery, but you're not quite in the promised land. And you're stuck in this in-between. Have you ever been there? Well, you're not flat out and rebellious against God. Your life isn't flat out just completely destroyed. But I wonder how many of us today would have the guts to say, look, I don't know what God's will is for my life or God's plan for my life, but whatever it is, I don't think this is it. Whatever it is, this can't be what he wants for me. I'm not in slavery, but this isn't quite the promised land. And they're stuck in this middle and this constantly being oppressed and the staleness and the slavery that comes with it. This dryness of trying to walk with God, but you're not having the fulfillment of God. Trying to be a Christian, but you don't have the joy that comes with it. You don't have peace that comes with it. You don't have the contentment that comes with it. You don't have all the other fruits of the Spirit that I can't even think of right now that comes with it. All this stuff isn't in your life. Just thinking, where am I supposed to be at right now? And Israel finds themselves because they walk with God till it gets difficult. Then they choose a little bit their own doing, and they are once again, and sin will make slaves of us all. People, there's no freedom in sin. Whatever it is that brings us that joy, whatever it is that brings us that satisfaction, whatever it is that brings us that momentary, we end up becoming a slave to. It's the very thing that's ripping us off from this life with God. And Israel has another once again. And God sold them into the hands of Jabin, the king of Canaan. It's an interesting word structure there. It picks up the exact same thing in Romans 1, where it said, God will give you over, let you go to your depraved mind. God will give you over to the lust, the desires of your flesh. God will give you over to your own gratification. God will give you over to your own relationships, your own wants, desires. You have this incredible God that says, man, if that's what you want, that's where you're going, I'll sell you to it. I'll let you have it. It's called free will. But for 20 years, it's ripped you off. And the people cry out to God. And let me tell you a second part of the problem. Israel at this time, they're following people or programs, not a purpose. They're following people or programs, not a purpose. It seems like every time we have a once again, somebody has died. In this chapter, Ehud died. And I know you're sitting there going, who's an Ehud? Ehud has a short little story in chapter 3. He was the last guy that saved you. He was the last guy that killed the Moabite king, came back to the mountains, blew his horn, your people rallied to him, and you were able to overtake all that was oppressing you. Ehud was the last success that you had. Ehud was the last leader that you were following. Your presidents are gone, and these people called judges that God rises up. Your last one is gone. Oh, North Coast, I hope you get this. North Coast, I hope you realize this. I'm up front because I have a teaching gift. It's not because I'm more spiritual or special than any one of you. I'm not. I'm the exact same dude. I'm just a dude trying to figure out life and follows God. I just happen to have a pretty strong teaching gift. Larry's up here because he's the smartest guy in the room. But besides that, he's got a teaching gift. He's just a regular dude like the rest of us. The guys that are up here that lead music and worship are up here because they have musical gifts in all of our venues, in all of our campuses, in our campus pastors, whether you're in Fallbrook, whether you're in Green Oak, whether you're in Kailua, in San Marcos, Escondido, Carlsbad, wherever you are, there's people up that have leadership gifts. But I hope your Christianity isn't based on a leader or a church. I hope your Christianity has nothing to do with I go to North Coast. I hope your Christianity isn't about where you go on a weekend. These people were following people and programs. They weren't following their own individual purpose. And you go, Chris, what's the purpose? You can write next to purpose, Exodus 19. Exodus 19, I actually hit it a couple weeks ago. Well, right before they got in the promised land, on the way through the wilderness, God called them, gave what's called a Mosaic covenant, where he showed up and said, Moses, tell your people, if you follow me and obey my commands, then out of all the world, you will be my treasured possession. You will be for me a kingdom of priests. If you follow God and his commands, then you are his treasured possession, a priest, a relationship with God in such a way where there's no one or nothing that stands between you. And you're able to show the rest of the world who this God is. North Coast, it's 7 days a week. Do you know your purpose? you walk with God, and it's not dependent on a church or a pastor or someone else teaching. But we wake up every day and I realize my goal is to follow God. And I get to be his treasured possession, this incredible relationship, and through that and in me and through me to show that love to others. And Israel's constantly hanging on people or programs, not their individual purpose. And thirdly, Israel didn't realize that victory doesn't mean you're right with God. Victory does not mean you're right with God. And Israel's been stuck with the same type of stinking thinking that we get sometimes. Where if life's going good, if things are all right, it must mean I'm right with God. And Christians, we get this. It's only Western Christianity that gets us. Most of the world doesn't even apply that. But here in America, for whatever reason, it's been ingrained in us. We think that if life's going good, it must mean I'm right with God. And yet the fallacy of that is so apparent. There are incredible people that are living a great life that have nothing to do with God. And the contrary, there's some amazing men and women that walk with God that live in the poorest, the most poverty-stricken of areas. Life going well has nothing to do with your walk with God. And yet somehow we've equated the two together. It's Pharisees and from the New Testament. And it couldn't be further apart. You can't walk throughout places in the world today, in the slums of Nairobi, in the shanties of South Africa. You can't walk through the streets of Haiti today and go, well, God must hate these people. Your condition of life has nothing to do with the condition of your heart. And yet we'll fall into the trap of thinking, if life's going good, it must mean I'm going well with God. Closeness to God is only measured by closeness to God. You know that? And I wish there was a meter. I wish there was a God meter that we could see through the lens of our eyes. Don't you? Like a video game. This little meter that always told me if I needed to power up or not. This little meter that told me if my spiritual battery was full. And I don't even want percentages. It can just be green, yellow, and red. And when you know when you get to the red, you better do something. I wish we had a video. Sometimes I think I'm a little smarter than God. Because I think of this stuff and go, you should have designed us with that. That's a no-brainer, God. That would have been smart. I'm going through life and everything. I got this little God meter and I just give it a little check. Oh, I'm green. I'm good. It gets yellow and I'm like, I got to pray a little bit. I got to get a little something going. Maybe I'm going to go to church even if the Chargers are playing. I better do a little something. That baby gets to red and I just pull over and I'm like, I'm reading 5 pages. I'm doing 5 pages right now. God, I'm not quite even yellow. I'll do a couple more pages. I'll pray for people I don't like. Bing. Oh, I'm back in the yellow. And the truth is, we don't care about running green. We'll be right above the red and the yellow, and most of us will just sail through. But I'm like, well, why weren't we created? Then in our retina and the lens, we could just see a little God meter. Israel's looking at life as a God meter. They've had success for 80 years. That's the end of chapter 3. Life's going good. So they assume that must mean I'm right with God. And nothing could be further from the truth. And because they've left stuff in their life that they were supposed to wipe out. Because they stopped short of following God when things got tough. They once again decided to pick up on a little bit of the world. Once again decided to follow their own hearts and desires and not God's. And the scariest thing I know about God is given enough time, he will give us exactly what we want. And if you want to choose your own way, your own desires, your own sin, your own path, he will sell you over to it. He'll let you go. And sin brings this cycle of staleness and slavery, and there's no freedom in it. And Israel's there. And that's the setting and the time and the scene. And now here's the coolest story. Deborah was a prophetess, the wife of Lapidoth. She was leading Israel at that time. And she held court under the palm of Deborah between Ramah and Bethel in the hill country of Ephraim. And the Israelites came to her to have her disputes decided. And she sent for Barak, son of Abinoam, from Kedesh in Naphtali. And she said to him, "The Lord, the God of Israel, commands you, go take with you 10,000 men of Naphtali and Zebulun and lead the way to Mount Tabor. I will lure Sisera, the commander of Jabin's army, with his chariots and his troops to the Kishon River and give him into your hands." And people cry out to God and God raises up another leader and her name is Deborah. And we don't need to make excuses for that. There's always people that come and go, well, there must not have been any men that were following God. He had to use a woman. People go, why do you think he used a woman? Because women have absolutely no problem leading spiritually. And the best heart and the best mind he could find at that time was a woman named Deborah, and you don't have to make an excuse for it. There's great men, and there's men that are leading at that time. But in chapter 4, he raises up a woman named Deborah. And underneath the palms of Deborah, people come with their disputes. And God's given her wisdom. And one day she sends for her general, and Barak comes in. I love this dude. Name my boy after this dude. Partly because the honesty he's about to have and what he goes through. Partly because he has no problem listening to, spiritually, socially, and relationally, a woman. And if you're going to have success in life as a guy, you better get that one down. It's a good name for a boy. So she calls for Barak. He walks into her court. She says, you know, the guys that have been oppressing us have 900 tanks and an army. He's like, I'm well aware. He's the general. God's going to lure them out into the flatlands. Go fight them. I love his next line. Barak said to her, if you go with me, I'll go. But if you don't go with me, I ain't going. And God said, print it. That's good Bible. There are debates about where the heart of this guy is. A lot of people say he's a man of no faith. He's a chicken-hearted leader. He's a yellow-bellied guy. He's got no courage. He's got no faith in God. And this right here shows it. And I understand that. I tend to take a different approach. I tend to take a guy that says, look, God hasn't been moving or speaking here in quite some time. But if God's speaking through you, then I want you with me. Because if you're with me, I know God's with me. And you may call it a lack of faith. But if you're asking me to take my man up against 900 tanks named Fury, God better be with me. I love the way he yields to a woman who's listening to God. And I love his honesty. Sure, maybe he should just have charged a tank. Sure, maybe he should just have heard that and ran. But I look at this guy and he realizes, look, if God's not with me, I don't want to have part of this. And right now God's with you. You're the best mind and voice of God we have. If you're with me, I'll ride. But without you, I stay. And her response, very well, Deborah said, I'll go with you. But because of the way you are going about this, the honor will not be yours. For the Lord will hand Sisera over to a woman. So Deborah went with Barak to Kadesh, where he summoned Zebulun and Naphtali. 10,000 men followed him, and Deborah also went with him. And Deborah goes, okay, I get it, but here's the deal. Because of that statement, the honor of killing the commander won't be yours. A woman will get to do that. By the way, there's only one woman going to battle. You know it's coming. And you have to understand, 1300 BC, when a king killed another kingdom, that king got to behead that king. If your battle was fought simply between commanders, when the commander of one army defeated a commander of the other, your men would not lay hands on the other king, general, or commander, except to subdue him. You would always bring that to the commander or king that won, and his honor was to kill or behead the leader. It's the way it was done, 1300 BC. And Deborah's saying, great, but because you want me to go with you, it's the hand of a woman that will have the honor of killing Sisera. That won't be yours. And I think Barak's like, so you're telling me I won't die? Let's go. It's just what I need to know. Because you're going up against 900 tanks in the open field. Now remember, at this time, Israel is a bunch of ex-slaves. They've been wandering in the wilderness. They're very new in the promised land. They haven't had time to build up this huge military defense. They have no weaponry per se of their own, except handheld. You got some swords, you got some spears. You're a bunch of farmers who are from ex-brick makers. You're farmers who take your pitchfork and your shovels to battle. And it's mad hand-to-hand combat, but when you're going up against tanks and an army... And he gives orders to his men to move out. And they're coming down the hills. And they see on the plains, lined up by the Kishon River, the tanks, as deep and as far as you can see. And every man's got to be wondering, how in the world did we ever get ourselves into this battle? The woman there said so. And here we go. Verse 11. Now Heber the Kenite had left the other Kenites, the descendants of Hobab, Moses' brother-in-law, and pitched his tent by the great tree in Zananim near Kadesh. Now I have no idea what that's about. Have you ever been reading the Bible and all of a sudden it just throws something in there and you're like, that's on the wrong page. We've got a battle scene, Barak coming down, 900 tanks, a woman's with them going to battle. God said, I can do this. And by the way, some distant backwoods relative from down south just moved up north and he's got a U-Haul under a tree. Yeah, what do you do with that? When you get to parts in the Bible where there's a verse that seems out of place, let me tell you, theologically, you skip it. So that's what we're going to do. It's like this, it's a commercial break. It's like you're getting all intense. It's like this battle is brought to you by U-Haul. Thanks. Here we go. Some dude down south moved up north and he found himself a tree. Yay, Hobab. Verse 12. Now when they told Sisera that Barak son of Abinoam had gone up to Mount Tabor, Sisera gathered together his 900 iron chariots and all the men with him from Harosheth Hagoyim to the Kishon River. Then Deborah said to Barak, go, this is the day the Lord has given Sisera into your hands. Has not the Lord gone ahead of you? Well, I don't know. How do you know? They come down to the valley from the hills. You see the plain, 900 chariots, Sisera, commander of the people that have been raping and pillaging you for 20 years. His troops, you've got 10,000 farmers. And she's all, go. Hasn't God gone ahead of you? And he's like, I can't really tell. How do you know? If a giant cloud came down from heaven with like thunder and lightning and started blowing tanks up, you're like, God's gone ahead of you. You just run behind. Don't get too close, but you run behind. If there's some great big giant of the transformer God just starts wiping out chariots, you're like, God's gone ahead of you. But that's not how he works. How do you know if God's gone ahead of you? How can you tell? Let's get real. In the chariots that you're facing today, in the battles that you're going through, in the relationship issues, in the heartache, in the brokenness, in the marriage that's torn up or cold or abusive, in the lack of marriage, in the hurt of singleness, in the loss of someone, with the health, with the finances, with the work, with the envy, with the strife, with the... How do you know if God's gone ahead of you? Deborah seems to think it's pretty clear. She's all, see, Barak, go. God's gone ahead of you. And he goes, that looks like a bunch of chariots to me. How do you know? I stopped for a second on that. Man, it hit me. Do you know? You can know for sure that God's already gone into your battle ahead of you if you're following exactly what God's told you to do. Think about this for a second. It's actually a lot simpler than I thought. If you're following God, then who's ahead of you? That's why it's called following. This is new to some of us, and I'm like, I've been saying I've been following God my whole life, and I couldn't believe it. He's been in front of me. Yes! Deborah says, I told you to get the men from Zebulun, from Naphtali, the amount of men, to come down here. We've done everything God's told us to do. Therefore, God is in front of us. He's gone ahead of us. I know we can't see it. I know we don't get it. But God's there in front of us. And let me tell you why this is so clear. And let me tell you why we got to get this. Because Israel is going to do once again, once again, once again, once again, once again. I start following God until I see the chariots. That was verse 19, chapter 1. We got to get out of here. We can't do this. I once again follow God until it hurts me financially. I once again follow God until I can't do relationally what I want to do relationally. I once again follow God until he starts encroaching on my own freedoms of sexuality. I once again follow God until he wants me to handle my anger, my bitterness, my explosive rage at home. I once again follow God until he wants to take down some of my crutches. Maybe it's my alcohol. Maybe it's my smoking weed. Maybe it's my relaxation method. I once again follow God until he gets into an area that's difficult. And then I once again choose what's right in Chris's eyes. End of the book. Without a king, Every man does what he sees fit. If there is not a king in my life, if this is not the law of God, the word of God that encompasses every aspect of my life, if God is always going to be a counselor, if God is always going to be an advisor, if God is always going to be a good option if it agrees with me, then he's not king. And if I'm not following, he's not king, then I don't know if he's in front of me. In fact, scratch that. If I'm not following him, then I know he's not out in front of me. And it doesn't take much. When Chris is following God and doing what God has asked me to do, even though I can't see it, I know God is in front. But the moment I decide to act on Chris, the moment I do what I see fit, and it may just be a degree or two off, then what's out in front of me? Chris's goals, Chris's wants, Chris's plan for Chris's life, Chris's dreams. And church campuses, let me tell you why it scares me to death. Because I've got a beautiful wife. I've got 3 kids. And there is no way I want to be responsible for them. No way. I'm trying my best to be responsible to them. But to take responsibility for them? No. I don't even know where they are right now. You're like, you don't know where your family is? Nope. I only know where you are. I know where my family's supposed to be, but especially the little one, I have no clue where he is right now. I know I got some girls somewhere running around this campus leading worship, I think with K1. That's what they tell Dad. I don't know if they're there or not. I tell you what else scares me. I don't know who's watching them. I don't know who's watching my home right now. I don't know what cells are growing in my wife's body right now. I don't know the health of my kids 3 years from now, let alone 30. There's so much I cannot be responsible for. I can't. It scares me to death. So my job is to make sure I'm walking with God. I'm not stopping short in obedience. I'm not choosing what's right. And then even though I don't see him, I know, God, you are on this battle. You are in these finances. You are in this health situation. You are in the relationship. You are in the struggles. You are in the deal with the neighbors. You are in the business. You're in the coworker. You're in the boss. You're in the employee. God is in the situation. If I am following him, I am following him. Therefore, he is out in front. But the moment we decide that some obedience is enough, and we decide just to do things our way, he is not in front of us. He's not in front of us. There is obedience, and any degrees off of obedience, he's no longer in front of us. Does that make sense? And I know you hear this go, oh, so I have to be perfect? No. God doesn't want the perfection of our life. He wants the direction of our life. And when I do have a once again, Chris went back to, God has a once again. Once again, I can give mercy. Once again, I can give grace. Once again, I can give forgiveness. And I have never been able to out once again God. And every time I've fallen off track of obedience, Chris once again did life his own way. And I stop and I cry out. God once again shows incredible mercy and grace and forgiveness and raises up a Deborah or a Barak. And every time I have once again sin, God says, I see you once again and I raise you one. There's grace and mercy for you, son. But you got to come back and walk. And Deborah has the wisdom, the godliness to see it. Barak, we followed God. He's out in front. Don't look at the massive army and chariots. Go. So Barak went down Mount Tabor, followed by 10,000 men. And at Barak's advance, the Lord routed Sisera and all of his chariots and army by the sword. And Sisera abandoned his chariot and fled on foot. But Barak pursued the chariots and army as far as Harosheth Hagoyim. All the troops of Sisera fell by the sword. Not a man was left. Sisera fled on foot. And I read this and go, well, that was the lousiest battle ever. That's all you're going to give me? You got this huge buildup to Barak and 10,000 and the chariots. And all it says is, oh, and by the way, God routed them. And credits roll up the screen. And I'm like, that's all I get? And my wife's happy. That was the best battle ever. We didn't have to see anybody die or anything. I'm like, I want my money back. And I want $23 for this popcorn back too. That's crazy. That the Lord routed Sisera and all of his men. That's all we get. Don't you feel cheated out on some really cool scenes right there? Or is it just a guy talking? I tell you what I didn't get. I didn't get that in chapter 5, Barak and Deborah do a duet. Now, I said this in one of the other services. I go, weird, man. This general just gets done fighting, and he gets up and writes a song and sings a duet. Weirded me out. And then my worship leaders came right back and go, what the heck, dude? We write songs all the time. And I'm like, oh, snap. That was just West Texas dude talking. Like guys that write songs, write lyrics, great stuff. What I'm saying is, we got a battle scene, and you usually don't find a general go up, sit underneath the palm tree with Deborah and sing a duet. But they pull one off, and it's really cool. And there's some lyrics in their song about their battle that tell us exactly what happened on the battlefield. The very next chapter, chapter 5, we have the song. And I imagine it's all done with like electric harps and a lot of percussion. Just bang! That's just me. If you're in traditions, it was all piano and organ. So here we go. Judges 5, verse 4. O Lord, when you went out from Seir, when you marched from the land of Edom, the earth shook, the heavens poured, the clouds poured down water, the mountains quaked before the Lord, the one of Sinai, before the Lord, the God of Israel. Now it sings about the battle and all that happened, but go to verse 20. From the heavens, the stars fought from their courses. They fought against Sisera. The river Kishon swept them away. The age-old river, the river Kishon. March on, my soul, be strong. Now, all we have in chapter 4 is the Lord routed Sisera and his chariots. In chapter 5, Barak and Deborah get together, sort of a little Kenny Rogers duet type thing, do this little duo, and they put the lyrics to it. And Barak says, when we went out to battle, we set foot on that field, and the heavens fought for us. They poured out rain, and the mountains shook. You get the picture. It's lyrics. It's Hebrew poetry. There is a thunderstorm that rolls on this valley that quakes the rocks, and the valley gets drenched. In verse 20, we read, it's as if the stars were fighting the battle. It's as if the heavens. This wasn't done at night. Again, it's poetic liberty. It's as if the heavens just fought for us. And that river, that age-old river Kishon, flooded its banks. Now get a picture. How well do iron chariots do in the open flatland? Really well. And that's where the battles fought. But how well do iron chariots work in a flood and mudded field? They become anchors. And if that river, if the rains came down in this valley, and if this valley filled with water and mud, these chariots are not just of no help, they're a hindrance. And now we know why every man fled on foot. By the way, who does really well in mud? Farmers with shovels and pitchforks. And Barak's leading his men down, a bunch of farmers looking at tanks, and Deborah's all, God's ahead of you. And as they hit the field, the heavens poured, the streams rose, flood stage, horses and chariots of are no use, thunder is distorting the beasts that are supposed to pull them anyway, and farmers get a grin ear to ear. Shovel and pitchfork are made for mud. And by the way, a charioteer is great at handling the rig, but you put him in the mud against the farmer, come on. It's like taking a NASCAR driver and throw him into a cage match. Now, NASCAR, they're athletes, I guess. But you got these guys. First of all, you have to fit through an open window. So guys like me are out. I'm like, where's the door? Can't. Well, I can't ride. They're like little 5 foot nothing guys that wear $500 sunglasses, and they're pretty. And that's cool. They drive cars fast. But you throw them into a muddy cage match, bye-bye Jeff Gordon. Bye-bye Jimmy Johnson. Farmers are going to have their way. What a story. Now to all my worship guys, thanks for giving us good lyrics. It still not doesn't help the first service, but that's okay. I'll dig my own way out of this hole. Oh, Sisera. I almost forgot about Sisera. He's on foot. He's running. Check it out. Verse 17. Sisera ever fled on foot to the tent of Jael, the wife of Heber the Kenite. Jael, the wife of Heber the Kenite. Heber the Kenite. Heber the... Where have we heard of Heber the Kenite? He's the guy from down south. They got a U-Haul moved up by the big tree. Oh, the commercial break, dude. No. So he's on the run. He comes across the people that moved from down south up north. He came across his wife, Jael, of Heber the Kenite, because they were friendly relations between Jabin, the king of Hazor, and the clan of Heber the Kenites. Sisera comes through, sees a family that's just moving from down south up north under a tree, finds out who she is, and realizes, hey, we actually got a treaty between your people and my people. Kind of distant, kind of way far off, but I need some help here. Jael went out to meet Sisera and said to him, come, my lord, come right in. Don't be afraid. So he entered her tent, put a covering over him. I'm thirsty, he said. Please give me some water. And she opened a skin of milk and gave him a drink and covered him up. Now stand in the doorway of the tent, he told her. And if someone comes and asks you, is anyone here? Just say no. And now you got the picture. He's on the run. Can you imagine what's going through his mind? I've been raping and pillaging these guys, women, children, and land for 20 years. If they catch me, my God, what are they going to do? And he's on the run. And out in the middle of nowhere, there's people that have just moved from down south up north. You got to help me. You got to hide me. She goes, oh, my Lord, come right in. And she puts him in the back of the tent. And she takes a quilt and she puts it over him, puts some stuff around him. His little voice, I'm dying of thirst. He's been in a battle. He's been running for his life. Can I have some water? Better than water. I got some warm milk for you. And she brings some milk for him. You see what happens? When you've been in a battle, when you've been running for your life, when you're laying still, when you've got a blanket over you with some warm milk. He's out cold. She's standing at the door. He's got safety. If guys come up, have you seen anybody come this way? No, we just moved from down south. We haven't met anybody yet. But Jael, Heber's wife, picked up a tent peg and a hammer and went quietly to him while he lay fast asleep, exhausted. And she drove the peg through his temple into the ground and he died. Ooh. Bet you didn't see that one coming. Oh, remember back in the beginning, underneath the palms of Deborah, where Deborah said, you got to go, and Barak said, I'll go, but you got to go with me because you're God, and where can I go? And remember she said, okay, but because you just asked that, the honor won't be yours. It will be given to a woman. Didn't you think it was going to be Deborah? Because she was, didn't you? Of course, she's the only woman in the story. Not some foreign, distant, almost kind of relative to Moses who moved up from south to north. And she gets the tent peg and the mallet. And in those days and age, and I'm not trying to be sexist, with a nomadic culture and group of people, when they set up camp, the men would go and find water sources and game and food and to get the surrounding area. The women would set up tent. Women are good with mallets and tent pegs. 1300. And it was just what... Now, Barak and his troops come up looking for this guy. And as they start moving up the hill, they came by in pursuit of Sisera. Jael went out to meet him. Come, she said, I'll show you the man you're looking for. So he went in with her. And there lay Sisera with the tent peg through his temple, dead. On that day, God subdued Jabin, the Canaanite king, before the Israelites. And the hand of the Israelites grew stronger and stronger against Jabin and the Canaanite king until they destroyed him. Can you see the scene? Barak coming up with his men. Hey, lady, where do you come from? Well, we just moved from down south. We found a big tree. I got that. Verse 11. Hey, have you seen the guy come through here? She's like, yes, he's in my tent. I wonder if Barak pulls her. We'll handle this. Four of you. Go. three. Got their swords out. Coming into the tent. Pull back the blanket. Oh! Nice job, lady. We'll take it from here. Gone. Guy's nailed to the floor. Oh, the solution. Let me give you two things to take home. Not just one of the coolest stories in the Bible. Let me give you a solution. Oh, church, hear this and understand it. Give me a little bit of freedom with it. We call out to a warrior, not a wimp. When you pray, when you sacrifice your hopes and dreams and follow this God and he is out in front, I hope you fully realize that we are following a warrior, not a wimp. And here's why I want to say that. Because unfortunately, I grew up in a church that was teaching me different. I grew up in a church where everything God was pretty much melted down into Jesus. And sometimes, because that's the best picture of God we have, I think some of us, when we pray and we think of our God, we think of Jesus. Let me give you a hint. Knock it off. Jesus did not come to earth to show us who God was. He set aside his Godhead. He set aside his equality with God. He came to earth to take on the very form of a man to show us how we were supposed to live. When you look at Jesus, that's a picture of how we live. That is not a picture of God. And here's why I want to get that out of your head. Because we have to pray. Because you're facing chariots. Because some of you are getting beat down right now. Because some of you have sold yourself back to your once agains in life. And they're kicking your butt. And I don't need a guy in a skirt that makes sick people well come visit me. When I pray, I have to realize, man, I pray to a God who's a warrior, not a wimp. I did this about 7 years ago, but I want to do it again because I love pictures. So I pull out the flannel graph every now and then. See, growing up, I always had different heroes that I played with. And there was always, by far, there was just this guy. Faster than a speeding bullet, more powerful than a locomotive. I mean, the guy can fly. He's got x-ray vision, laser vision. His breath can blow things away or freeze things. I mean, Superman was just the epitome of power. You're in a place where you need help. You get this guy, right? And no one beats him. He's the best superhero of all time. Don't come up and argue afterwards. Actually, I like Aquaman. Shut up. You need water. It's this guy. This guy. But here's the problem. I grew up in West Texas where they always said, but Chris, this is your God. And I accepted that. This is your God. And they would put him on the board and they would talk about him. And they'd say, okay, here's Jesus. And this is my God. But here's my problem. I grew up, and I needed a God that I think could come through for me. I need to know if I'm following this. Who is it that I'm following? And I kept getting this weird picture that this is my God. This is God that came and said, I'm setting aside God. It's Philippians 2. I'm coming to show you, Chris. No. This is how you're supposed to live. But this isn't a picture of your God. Back in Exodus 19, when I told you, God told his people, if you follow me, then you'll be my treasured possession. Remember, I hit it a couple weeks ago, the high voltage God, where he drew a line around the mountain. He said, I want all of Israel to come out and see. I'm about to show up. I'm going to give you a glimpse of the God that's calling you into following. And remember, it said the mountain blew up with a furnace like smoke and flames. There was thunder and there was lightning and there was a massive earthquake. And there was a God that said, if you cross this line, you'll die. You cannot fathom the power of your God. You cannot get close to the power of your God. He goes, that's the picture I want my children to have. And somehow we substituted and said, oh, this is the God I pray to. And he's the God that when you pray, he shows up with like a cookies and milk and a get well card. And he's supposed to make everything okay. And you go, Chris, are you mocking Jesus? Not at all. I'm mocking what we've done with the theology of Christ. Because no one ever told me growing up that, Chris, you got to understand, your God comes in camouflage. Your God shows up as a warrior. And when you cry out because you are his treasured possession, he doesn't show up with a get well card. He shows up with thunder and lightning and smoke like a furnace. You know, this is the might of your God. And you know, sometimes he doesn't even use power. Sometimes he shows up in a U-Haul truck. And I've forgotten this. I'd forgotten the second thing I want you to write down. Don't discount God's might or minutia. Yes, you have to look up to know how to spell minutia. It's just for you. Do it with an SH. It's fine. Minutia. I have a God that says, Chris, your job is to follow. So I am a warrior God that's out in front. And I may use my power, I may use my might, or I may use some lady who just moved up north from down south, a distant secondhand backwoods relative, under a tree with a U-Haul truck. Because that's where your answer is going to lie. And I tell you what, I don't care what he uses. As long as I know he's there and I'm following, and it can be in the little things or the big things of life. But people always come up and say, Chris, what's your favorite Jesus story? You love teaching the Bible. It seems like every week's your favorite story, and that's true. What's your favorite Jesus story? It's really short. And I want to read you my favorite Jesus story, and I want you to listen. It says, I saw heaven standing open. And there before me was a white horse whose rider is called Faithful and True. With justice, he judges and makes war. His eyes are like a blazing fire, and on his head are many crowns. He has a name written on him that no one knows but he himself. How bad do you have to be to have a name that no one understands but you? People go, what's that mean? You can't handle it. Okay. Says, you want to know who your Jesus is? He has a name and a title that no one can fathom but him. You can't even understand your God. So I'll give you the words he gives you. He's dressed in a robe dipped in blood, and his name is the Word of God. The armies of heaven were following him, riding on white horses, dressed in fine linen, white and clean. Are you kidding me? If your army comes out in white linen, they know we ain't getting dirty. We're just following him. Oh! Out of his mouth comes a sharp sword with which to strike down the nations. He will rule them with an iron scepter. He treads the winepress of his fury, of the wrath of God Almighty. And on his robe and written on his thigh, he has this name, King of Kings and Lord of Lords. Revelations 19. That's my favorite Jesus story. In Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and John, he came to earth to show us how to live as men and women. But Revelation says, oh, you better understand your Jesus. He's different than healing the sick and the blind. He showed us how to love in God's love. But never, ever confuse that with he came to show us God. That's my God. And I don't love that picture because I want people to be judged. I love that picture because there are chariots and hurts and pains in our life. And I don't want to cry out to a God that says, well, if you give me a lunch, I'll multiply it. Well, my mom did that growing up. I want to call out to a God that says, buddy, you are my treasured possession, and treasured possessions are worth fighting for. And this is the God you have. By the way, you can't touch it. Yes. And my job is to make sure I'm following that God, not stopping short, not choosing what's right in my own eyes. Because the moment we're choosing what's right in our own eyes, that God is no longer out in front. Our hopes and dreams are out in front. And I don't want to be in charge of my life. Can't do it. Not with who's in it. Not worth it. Where are you at today? Where are you stopping short? What are you choosing in your life besides obedience? I promise you, whatever slavery or staleness you find yourself, whatever once again you've fallen back into, there is a cross of another. Once again, there is grace. Once again, there is mercy. Once again, there's forgiveness. But it's up to us to cry out and to fall back in line and to say, that's the God that's out in front. I told you, going to be one of your favorite stories in the Bible. Until next week. I'm going to ask you to hang out for just a moment after we pray and do a song. I'm going to invite you to do something our church rarely does. And I want to come back and say a couple things and let you know what's happening here in North Coast coming up that you may want to be a part in. If you got to leave, I get that. But if you can stay to the very end, I got a special announcement. God, thanks for who you are. God, I'm so sorry for confusing the Jesus of the Bible for who God is. But that you came to show us how to live as men and women. You came to show us how to live life with God. That body you took on was human. And God, today we needed to know and hear that there is a God much bigger than that we prayed to. So may you give us the strength and courage to leave what needs to be left. To ask forgiveness for whatever needs to be forgiven for. To move away from whatever's taken us back to once again. God, may you give us your spirit in our life, through our life, to change us from the inside out. To be people that know without a doubt we are following you and therefore you are out in front of our problems. God, may you give us the strength to make whatever changes need to be made to find obedience today. And thank you that no matter who we are and what we've done and how many once agains we have, you outdo us with once again forgiveness, grace, and mercy. In Jesus' name, amen.
So before we close, if you want more information about this teaching or any other teaching, just go online, www.northcoastchurch.com. Or you can come see us at 2405 North Santa Fe Avenue in Vista, California. Check the website for times of services. And now let's get back to some closing thoughts from Pastor Chris.
You know, as you go, I want to just tell you, we do something about every year and a half called Weekend of Service. It's the biggest thing in the community that North Coast does. If you're new, and I know there's over 1,000 of you that are new since the last time we did it, we cancel all of our services for one weekend, all 32 service options. And instead of coming to church, we go out and we become the church, which we should be doing year round anyway. It's why if you're in a growth group, we ask you to have community service projects every semester that you're in a growth group. That way we're doing two growth group projects a day every year across North County. But every year and a half, we get rid of all of our services and we all go out and do it together. Last year, 9,000 of you showed up on Saturday and Sunday. We completed over 220 projects on over 100 different sites for every campus, for every school, for every hospital, for every charity, for every nursing home, for a senior center, for anything we can get our hands on, Christian or non-Christian. We don't care. We just go out and we try to love people. And we did over $1.5 million of billable services. Now, of course, we don't charge anybody for it. But it takes something to pull it off. We take a little bit, we turn it into a bunch of paints, brushes, rollers. We pay all of you nothing, and that's how we get it by so cheap. So I want to tell you it's coming up. It's going to be sooner than we think. It's the last weekend of April. So make sure that last weekend of April, you have it on your calendar. We want to do over 10,000 people this year out involved in projects. And here's what we could use your help with. If you want to be part of them, and I don't know who you are and which part of you, that go, I want to give to that. I want a little bit of my money in there to turn it into another great project. That's what we need to do right now. We need to get some money and find out what our budget is so we know how many thousand gallons of paints, rollers, screwdrivers, hammers, nails, everything we need to get and do. There's an envelope that looks like this. You can take that home and think about it, bring it back next week or mail it in. There's also in the back of every campus and every venue right now, greeters and ushers just at the door with a basket or a bucket. Anything you put in here, 100% of it goes in it. And for the first time, if you want a text to give and you go, man, I don't carry cash. I mean, who carries cash anymore? We text. If you want a text to give, there's a yellow sheet that tells you how to text to give anytime you want. We're going to get this going. I was out to eat this week at a restaurant, Felix's, I think it's called Felix's Southern Barbecue, Rancho Del Oro. Oh, best Southern comfort food. Woo! Tummy liked it. Owner was walking around talking to tables, came up and talked to me. We got in a conversation, asked about me, I told him where I was from, and he goes, North Coast. He goes, oh, I know that church. You guys do great things in the area. And I thought, man, if you want your church to have any one reputation, that's it. The church isn't buildings where you go to on the weekend. It's people who do great things in the area. And the moment we want to stop doing great things is the moment we got to stop calling ourselves a church. So if you're interested in just the funding and the seating of that, that's what this is about. The rest of us, circle your calendar, because we're going to use all of you. We are going to have a blast. Next week, we're going to pick it up with another hero or zero. Until then, turn around, greet another piece of treasured minutiae.